Stonehenge has an extraordinary effect because it is the earliest surviving theatre in the world. It's a theatre and a temple.
The stones are there to not just represent the dead, but to physically be the dead. They represent the idea at the heart of the universe, which is the sense of how you go into that other world and how the other world creates life in this never-ending circle.
Stonehenge, with its imposing and mysterious stones, dominates the landscape of Wiltshire. It sits majestic, surrounded by ancient burial mounds, standing stones, timber circles and henges. It's the most iconic monument in Britain, proudly taking centre stage in a landscape that was symbolic over thousands of years. And yet Stonehenge remains an enigma.
It was built by the devil.
A temple to the moon.
A temple restored to the British Druids.
It was built by the devil.
It was a huge fertility symbol.
It was an ancient computer
built by aliens.
It was the burial place.
It was a giant clock or calendar. A temple, the giants.
Over the centuries, many archaeologists have tried to crack the secret of Stonehenge. But some of their unscientific and often misleading conclusions have left us with a glut of theories, and most of them unlikely. The 800,000 annual tourists to Stonehenge can't get to the bottom of it either.
The Druids used it for some sort of worship.
Well, I think it was more of an altar where they would worship sun gods.
I think it was probably some sort of ancient religious structure.
It's probably an old ancient burial ground.
It's kind of eerie though. You know, there's an eerie feeling about it, you know.
Witches used to be brought up here. They do their special services or something up here.
Oh, it has a bit of a mysterious mystique.
I guess somebody clever mathematically worked it out to do with it.
Within the next 20 years, we'll probably send people to Mars, and we stand here looking at 5,000-year-old stones, and we still don't have a clue. It's amazing. It's just phenomenal.
But now the mystery of Stonehenge is closer to being understood. One of the biggest archaeological research projects of recent times is taking place in the surrounding landscape, and it's trying to link Stonehenge with a much bigger henge just over a mile away called Durrington Walls. A henge is basically a round, man-made ring of chalk surrounded by a bank and ditch on the inside, a bit like an amphitheatre. Now in its fourth year, the excavation is uncovering evidence that allows the archaeologists to piece together what Stonehenge was for, why it is where it is, and who exactly built it.
Well, we started in 2003, and we're hoping it's going to be a 10-year project, so we'll be finishing sometime around 2013, I expect.
The project's being led by Sheffield University's Professor Mike Parker-Pearson. Mike's an archaeologist specialising in the Neolithic period, that's 4,500 years ago, and he's got a leading team of experts on hand to help him.
Well, I think when you start a project like this, you have to involve the best. So I've recruited a team of very, very good archaeologists. We have over 100 students. We've got surveyors, we've got geophysicists. They're environmental archaeologists looking at the plant remains, the animal bones, the microstructure of the soil. And then we've got specialists in the actual excavation techniques, the recording systems, the data management, and so forth. So it's really the bringing together of the very best and making them work as a team, hoping they'll work as a team, and seeing what they come up with. A lot of people come here just to see Stonehenge, but it's not a monument in isolation. It's surrounded by archaeological remains from prehistory. There are burial mounds, what we call round barrows, and all sorts of other earthworks. And I think until now, no one's really been able to piece them together, to work out why it's here and why there's so much rich evidence from the prehistoric past.
During the project, Mike's been developing his theory to explain Stonehenge.
It wasn't an idea that developed out of careful study of this landscape. It came from left field, if you like, totally out of the blue, because I'd been working in Madagascar with a colleague, Ramilson. He flew over and we drove out here together, and he took one look at Stonehenge and said, "Right, Mike, you know what these are for, don't you? You know why they built this." And I said, "I have no idea." And he said, "It's obvious. They were built for the ancestors. Because in Madagascar, even today in certain areas, we still put up standing stones to commemorate the ancestors. And you live your life in timber structures, which are ephemeral, like the clothes that you wear. And all of these things are transient. So it marks the transition from one to the other."
So stone represents the dead, the ancestors, and timber represents the living.
And what that allowed us to do was to start rethinking this landscape, seeing it from a perspective we'd never even thought of before.
Mike was starting to link Stonehenge and Durrington Walls convincingly together.
10 years ago, any sane archaeologist would have said, well, Stonehenge dates to maybe as late as 2000, and Durrington Walls is going to be 500 years earlier, at least. We've discovered that some of the radiocarbon dates that were done 10 years ago were actually from the wrong contexts. That just leaves us with two dates, quite precisely now with the new advances in radiocarbon dating, to somewhere in the 26th century BC, considerably earlier than we'd thought.
Not only were they being built at the same time, around 2500 BC, but during the project, the team discovered an avenue that linked Durrington Walls to the river, just like at Stonehenge. For the first time, this was proof that the two sites were closely tied together as part of a single complex. One with a stone circle, the other timber. Mike thinks Durrington would be a place for feasting and celebrating. It was the starting place of a symbolic journey towards death.
We have a small number of bones which actually have the tips of flint arrows embedded into them. And these are actually pig bones and cattle bones, suggesting that we're actually shooting these arrows at domesticated animals, possibly as part of the sort of feasting process.
Usually Neolithic sites are short on finds, but week one here and the discoveries are fantastic.
We found some arrowheads over the far trench, just found a scraper.
We found several dozen bone pins, splinters of bone that have been highly polished, possibly on some small polishing stones we found in the same deposits.
Lots of things like apple pips and hazelnuts and flint blades, worked bone and things like that.
I got an arrowhead, which was fantastic. It's the only thing I've not found on this site so far, and I got one like today and it's like, yes!
The Stonehenge we see today dates to around 2500 BC, but it has a much longer prehistory and is by no means the oldest monument in this unique landscape.
We have some of the earliest monuments in the world. And where are they? They're right under the car park.
I can remember when they were discovered. What exactly did they get?
Well, they were dug up when the car park was being renovated, and it was early days in archaeology, back in the 1960s. And these were post holes, three of them, and small pieces of burnt charcoal were recovered from the pit. And these had been from the charred ends of the posts that had been set in them. No one thought very much about it. They went off to the laboratory, and a report came back to say that they were pine. And then a few eyebrows were raised, because this is not a pine landscape. These being pine, it meant that the pits had to be considerably older. And in fact, they date to about 8,000 BC, we now know from radiocarbon dating.
So that's right after the Ice Age.
Thereafter, it all goes a bit murky.
So what happened at Stonehenge in the era after the Ice Age? Well, it started life as a circular ditch and bank sometime around 3000 BC. But in the centuries after, they started adding to it in all sorts of different ways.
We have lots of post holes. So there was a timber monument there. Now, they were excavated not in the best scientific fashions of archaeology. This was back in the 20s.
It was a dog's breakfast,
let's
be honest.
They made a right old mess, I think. But whatever it is, I think we may be looking at many rebuildings of a variety of arrangements, which, of course, over the years would come to look rather messy and hard to decipher.
This pattern of coming back to a place and putting posts in the ground almost at random is something that we do know about from other sites in the area. Do you think that gives us a clue as to what was going on, you know, the why of Stonehenge?
There's nowhere that has more cremations than Stonehenge. 50 were excavated in those early days, and if you work out the area that dug, you can extrapolate from that to say there were probably 240 cremation burials were placed in there, and some of them are likely to have gone in at this time. I think the point is that even though it may be as many as 240, that's over many, many centuries. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if it was used as a place to bury people's ashes for the better part of 1,000 years. Mm. Now, that's not very many people when you look at the time dimension, and I suspect these may have been very special, different people, people who may have been important, powerful, or whatever, the kind of Westminster Abbey of its day in that sense.
The big change happened sometime before 2500 BC, when the first bluestones arrived from Wales, along with the huge sarsen stones from nearby. Shortly after that, Stonehenge took the form it is today. Dr. Mike Allen has been investigating the landscape and found clues for the very origins of Stonehenge.
I think previously we thought that much of the downlands were wooded and then cleared locally for these little monuments and things. The river valley might have been a tangled morass of vegetation, but our recent research now showing that we actually had, by the middle and later Neolithic periods, a really quite open, bald, treeless, grassy landscape.
And then Stonehenge would have been in a completely open landscape.
Stonehenge would have been almost having less trees on the environment than it does today. I'm not saying that the entire downlands were treeless. There would have been patches of wood because they needed it, obviously, for their fires, for their houses, their buildings. But around Stonehenge would have been quite nice, open pasture and arable landscape.
I mean, one of the most enigmatic things about Stonehenge are those huge posts in the car park, the Mesolithic posts. What you're saying sort of suggests that they could have been erected in a natural clearing in not very dense woodland.
That's precisely what I think happened. I think the Mesolithic people came into this landscape. It was quite open. They didn't have to cut down vast areas of trees, and they erected these large sort of huge posts or totemic poles in that area, and they visited them periodically, and that then became a special place, and therefore that's what started to imbue the entire landscape with some special reverence, some special activity. And from then on, the Neolithic people kept on reinventing that landscape in the way they wanted.
The second week of the excavation, and at Durrington Walls, the team have found the foundations of some houses. This is where the people who built Durrington Walls, and perhaps Stonehenge, would have lived.
Well, this one that we're looking at here is very typical. It's square, and it's about 5.5 metres by 5.5 metres. So it makes a bungalow look big. And you wonder how a sizeable family of six or more might have actually lived in it. It has a central square area, which is plastered. It looks as though the wall would have been a wattle and daub arrangement. They make a very strong structure indeed. The plaster area in the middle of the house is square, and then you have a circular or oval hearth right in the middle of that. Now, we have some extraordinary details which give an insight into people's lives. Immediately to the south of the hearth, there are two tiny little dimples in the floor, and this is where someone was either squatting or kneeling and doing the cooking. And you can see that they were also raking out the hearth, because the plaster of the floor is stained black on that side, but not on the other. And behind them, that is where we found pieces of pottery from the cooking pots that had been used within this part of the building.
So how many houses do you reckon were at Durrington at one time?
It's difficult to say. We know that we've got an active village, in that certain houses are clearly earlier or later than others. And of the half a dozen that we've excavated, They have to be just the tip of the iceberg.
It's also at Durrington that Mike can build up a clear picture of Neolithic logistics. In other words, how people organise themselves to build the huge monuments.
Well, I think the crucial thing about this huge Great Henge is that through the numbers of people that were living here in all of these houses, through the way that they constructed this ditch as a communal enterprise, I think we've actually got a very clear idea of how the organisation for Stonehenge was put together. We're looking at a segmented and modular form of social organisation, so that each section of ditch appears to have been dug by a particular group, taking a zone about 40 metres long. Where we've looked at the intersections between these groups, we can see that they've not only drawn a line, made a shallow gully to say, this is our bit, that's your bit, and we're going to dump our chalk here, you're going to dump your chalk there. And we reckon there are about 200 people in each of these sections. There are about 22 of them all the way around. So that's over 4,000 divided into segmentary groups of a couple of hundred, if not more. And that looks to me like the sort of size of a lineage or a subclan who may well probably hail from a particular region within southern Britain.
That's not all. The housing settlement being uncovered here is also pointing at a Neolithic class-based society. It's yet further evidence of how communities organise themselves to build these immense structures.
We're seeing social difference actually in the houses for the very first time in the Stonehenge area. So I think we're seeing a series of local leaders with their groups, presumably linked by kinship, who are all organising and organised into particular chapters with specific tasks to do. And I would imagine that one of those tasks is to be responsible for getting the big timbers to put up the timber circle here, and another would be to get and pull and dress the huge sarsen stones to put those up at Stonehenge as well. Stonehenge is the totally overdone emphasis on muscle. Huge amounts of labour involved, because not only do they quarry and drag these vast stones across really quite considerable distances, but they go to this enormous trouble of actually shaping them. There have to be individuals who are actually coordinating all the little local groups to say, you're going to do this bit, you're going to do that bit, and they're all coming together, working to that common purpose. In such situations, you may all start out as equal, but I suspect that by the end of it, there may well have been a group of head honchos running the show.
Week three, and there's been a unique find at Durrington, which could yet again rewrite our understanding of how sophisticated Neolithic people were. It concerns an ordinary piece of chalk, but possibly cut with a very interesting tool.
There's one very unusual mark, and it's a narrow blade-like cut. And my first thought was that this was made by an axe. Then when I looked more carefully, I could see that it wasn't wide enough to be made by a stone axe, because they have quite a bulbous end. And that made me think, well, perhaps this is actually made by one of these copper axes. Now, it's the right sort of shape, but unfortunately, because chalk weathers, we've lost the very fine detail within the cut itself. So it's really tantalising, but
personally, I mean, having done a lot of tree felling with flint axes and that sort of thing, I mean, I can tell you that if you swung a flint axe at chalk, you wouldn't have much flint axe left because it's got no resilience, and it would simply shatter, and a stone axe would be even worse.
Yes.
So I think copper makes every bit of sense.
The sheer size of the trees that people are tackling for felling is out of all proportion to previous centuries and the previous millennium. So there's a real change in scale in terms of what they're chopping down, but they've actually got rather better tools to do it with.
This could be the earliest evidence for the use of metal yet found in Britain, pushing back the arrival of copper by some 400 years. And on site, there's no shortage of other artefacts to tell us about life in this area 4,500 years ago.
Can you move it to your right?
please, yeah.
We found quite a few work chalk objects. They're very peculiar pieces of chalk, just trimmed to shape with an incised decoration on the surface and lattice.
We found quite a large piece of pottery, but we can't take it out just yet because it's in a sort of overlapping section.
And there's lots of little bits of flint and there's large bits of bone coming out of it as well.
Oh, over here, look, here's some groove. Let's have a look at that. Beautiful stuff. Quite a large pot decorated with these deep scored lines that resemble basketry. If this was in a museum, it would fill probably two galleries.
Teeth are quite common.
Oh, yeah, teeth come up as well.
What sort of teeth? Not human teeth.
No, animal teeth.
The evidence points to literally thousands of people coming to this region to construct huge monuments. But why build Stonehenge where it is? We know the area had long been significant, but why make the effort of bringing vast stones there? Well, perhaps they didn't. That's to say, we know the blue stones came from elsewhere, but it was always assumed that the Sarsen stone was bought from miles away. But Colin Richards of Manchester University has a rather different theory. During the project, he's found two huge standing stones nearby that were put up where they naturally occurred. And the heel stone at Stonehenge, he thinks, was here all along, just lying on the surface.
If you look at all the Sarsen at Stonehenge, it's all worked, apart from the heel stone and the two station stones. Why is this? Why weren't they incorporated in one way or another?
You tell me.
Well, I would hazard a guess that actually these were lying there, particularly the heel stone. Now, that is a very, very large stone. And if you've got stones, say, ranging up to 2 or 3 metres, occasionally occurring across this part of South Wiltshire, and then you've got a massive stone, like the heel stone lying there, that may be just the thing which they pull out as the very special stone, the extreme anomalous stone. And, of course, then you can say, well, maybe they enclosed it, and that could well be why Stonehenge is where it is.
So do you think that the heel stone could have attracted Mesolithic people back in, 7,000 BC, who were putting those posts up in the car park? Do you think they were actually congregating around the heel stone?
I think it's very likely, and I'm almost certain, actually, that a stone, say, the size of the heel stone, couldn't have been any other than a special thing for the people going back several thousand years before the Neolithic.
In the last week of a dig, a staggering discovery is made directly under the great banks of Durrington Wall's Henge.
Well, there's a house underneath it, and this is really important because we've got a sequence here. We've always thought that henges were built and then used. What we've discovered is the henge was built right at the end of everything. But that's just one house of, I was thinking that initially maybe hundreds, but I think there's probably more than 1,000 buried under the bank of this henge.
Good grief, that's sensational. Apart from anything else, it tells you how many people could have been living in the area. I mean, it's more than one community.
Yes, this is an enormous village. I can't think of anywhere in northwestern Europe at this time that would even have approached this scale.
I mean, it's quite sensational, isn't it? I've dug Neolithic houses, and normally there's just a trace of a post hole and possibly a hearth left by the modern plough damage. I mean, if you're underneath a bank, presumably things are pretty well intact, protected by the bank.
We've been doubly lucky, and it's brought it home to me how rare these circumstances are when you find this well-preserved material. It's not quite like Pompeii, but basically they've left stuff on the floor when they closed that down and knocked the walls away. So what that means is we've got all the little bits of debris, the pieces of smashed cooking pot, the animal bones from their meals, the flint tools that they were whittling away with in the house. So we can actually see just where they were carrying out all these different daily chores.
And there's one very special house they've found.
It's larger than all the others. It's also much more solid than the others, in that not only do you have traces, remains of what would have been a wattle and daub wall, but we've got a wall made of what's called cob, which is a typical traditional Wiltshire building material, and that's basically smashed up chalk, which forms a kind of plaster mix. And this is the earliest example of cob anywhere in Britain.
And I can see there's a dark pit there. Is that a pit full of hearth sweepings or...?
Yes, every house has a pit dug into one corner at the moment of abandonment. And this must be some sort of closing event. Not a house warming, but a house cooling, I suppose, in their terms. And I imagine that all the dark material in there, which is classic feasting deposit, because we've got lots and lots of big animal bones, this does seem to be the remains of maybe a final meal, last feast, a last supper of some sort.
Micah's ideas about feasting at Durrington Walls before the journey to Stonehenge and the afterlife. But Amanda Chadburn of English Heritage has her own theory on what Stonehenge was used for.
The main thing that I think it was for was to be a temple to the sun, crudely. The fact that it's aligned on that solstice axis, I think, is the only real clue that we've got, apart from the fact that it was also a cemetery as well in its earlier phase.
One of the things that's been very noticeable about the archaeological life of Stonehenge is all the different ideas that have attached to it. Are there other current theories around?
Yes, there are. And one of the key ones relates to Tim Darville and Jeff Wainwright's work. They've been doing a lot of work in Wales on the Preseli Mountains, and they're very, very interested in the bluestone connection. They have been looking at the way that bluestone has sort of been used over in Wales and how it's thought to have healing qualities and that kind of stuff. So they have been suggesting that perhaps Stonehenge was a place of healing, a cult place of healing. There's actually a number of different angles of research that are ongoing at present. It could be a sacred place, that could be a healing place, that could also be a cemetery, and it could also be a temple for the sun. You know, I mean, why not have all of them in the same place? If it's that important, you'd expect all these functions to be carried out here.
For Mike Parker Pearson, it's been a hugely successful season. They've got one of the biggest Neolithic settlements ever discovered in Northern Europe, have potentially got the earliest use of metal in Britain, and crucially, they've overturned nearly all our ideas about Stonehenge.
It is a sign of our times that we want to know what these things are for, but at the same time, it will always have a sense of mystery, because aspects will always continue to elude us. They're actually building on Earth the process by which people go into the other world. And it's not just who are we, where have we come from, where are we going? And that's what Stonehenge, I think, was trying to answer.